This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
No fluff, no guessing. When CFA Charterholder is on that resume, it means something real. Intensive study, tough exams, relentless drive, true grit, a strong network. Hiring managers get it instantly. The CFA Charter is more than letters after a name. It's proof of discipline, resilience, and integrity under pressure. It shows who you are before you even walk in the room. Explore what the Charterholder Advantage looks like at cfainstitute.org.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Since the UK's net inward migration figures for 2022 were revised upwards last week to a record 745,000, and with the former Home Secretary Suella Braverman accusing the Prime Minister of inaction, many column inches and broadcast minutes have been devoted to pronouncing on or agonising about the issue. Why is it that stated objectives for immigration over recent times have deviated so dramatically from actual outcomes? Or, to put it baldly, why have so many more people come to Britain than the government said it wanted? To understand that, you have to stop, take a breath, and look at the facts and causes of this unprecedented movement. So what is happening with migration? Who's coming who didn't used to, and why? And are things likely to continue like this? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First of all, let's start with the numbers. Exactly how many and who and how measured? Jay Lindop is the director of the Centre for International Migration at the Office for National Statistics. Jay Lindop, how are these figures actually calculated?
So we use different data sources for different group of migrants, namely non-EU, EU and British. So non-EU migration refers to estimates of migration for people who don't hold a British or EU nationality. And for those, we use Home Office borders and immigration data that combine visa and travel information to link an individual's travel movements into and out of the country. So if they stay for 12 months or more, they're classified as a long-term immigrant. And we do the same, but for those that have previously been immigrants, if we see them leave the country for 12 months or more, they're an immigrant. We can't currently use the same methods for EU migration because some EU migrants have got a right to come and go as they please on the EU settlement scheme. So to provide the best estimates for EU immigration, we use tax and benefits data from the Department for Work and Pensions. And what we do is we look for signs of activity over a period of time. And finally, for British, we still use our old method, which is the International Passenger Survey. So we survey people coming into and out of the country and ask them if they intend to stay for 12 months or more or leave for 12 months or more. We know that data source isn't perfect, but we are doing more research into look at what alternative admin data sources we can use for British.
So what's happened in this latest set of figures to EU relative to non-EU inward migrants?
So inward migration for EU, that was largely unchanged compared to the previous year. But for non-EU, we saw quite a big increase.
Now, let's go back to the revision upwards, which caused such a lot of commentary. Why did the figures have to be revised?
So we use the long-term definition of a migrant. That means somebody that changes their country of residence for 12 months or more. They are provisional because we have to use assumptions informed by past behaviours. That behaviour is starting to change, especially people staying in the UK for longer for study and work that have impacted on our assumptions. And it's those assumptions that we'll continue to understand and reflect in our future estimates.
Let's look at the different types of inward migration as you categorise them. What are they?
So we look at people coming for study and for work, for family reasons, humanitarian reasons, asylum, and then other.
And what type has seen the biggest growth?
So the biggest growth was actually work, although it wasn't the highest proportion. And we saw the numbers coming for work increase from around 23 to 33%. But actually, the largest proportion is made up of those coming to study.
Now, can we talk about people who come in as a result of other people coming in particular, in the first instance, say, how many students are now bringing in dependents?
So for study visas, we saw that increase quite significantly since the pandemic. So before the pandemic in 2019, around 6% of those coming on study visas were dependents, and that increased to around 25%. For work, we're seeing, I say, going back pre-pandemic, it was just over a third brought in dependents on work visas, and now that's just under a half.
Right. Now, let's talk about the nationalities of migrants coming in who are non-EU. Which are the top nationalities which entered in 2022-23?
So in the top five non-EU nationalities were India. Just over a quarter of all non-EU immigration were Indians. And that was followed by Nigerians, the Chinese, Pakistanis, and also the Ukrainians.
Can we just compare the numbers coming in as inward migrants with asylum seekers? What's the size of one and what's the size of the other?
So our numbers do include people that have claimed asylum, and that includes irregular migrants that also go on to claim asylum, because they generally take longer than a year to go through the application process and therefore are classed as long-term migrants. So in the year ending June 23, it's about 8% of all those coming in non-EU immigration were asylum seekers.
And just for context, what proportion of those arrived by boat?
Home Office data for the year ending June 23, I think, says there's just over 40,000 small boat arrivals, and we include 90% of those.
We've been talking here about legal migration, inward migration, and asylum seekers. Now, what about that entirely different category of illegal migration? What can we know about people who may have come here or stayed here illegally, and do we have actually any useful numbers?
So they would be difficult for us to pick up in our figures. We are working collaboratively with the Home Office to look at how we might measure illegal migration in the future. But for now, the official net migration figures that we're talking about today only include asylum seekers, and that will include that proportion of those that have come in illegally via small boats. And to some extent, it will include some of those that have come in on visas and then overstayed their visa.
OK. Jay, finally, let's talk about the other side of net migration, which is people leaving. Can you tell us a bit about that?
We can see that around 500,000 people left the UK long term in the year ending June 23, and that had gone up on the previous year from around 470,000. So, as I say, we're starting to see this increase in emigration over time, but we don't know if that's a long term trend. Around 215,000 of those were from the EU, and around 200,000 were from the non-EU. And then we also saw just under 100,000 of those were British. And that had gone up, not hugely, but gone up, which is why we can start to see this increasing in emigration over the last few months that may or may not sort of turn into a long-term trend.
Jay Lindop, so how did we get to this point of record immigration? To help us unpick some of the key moments in recent history is Heather Rolfe, Director of Research at the think tank British Future. Heather Rolfe, if we want to talk about the recent history of migration, where do you think we should start?
I think we should start from the post-war period, when labour and skill shortages were met by people largely from the Commonwealth and from Ireland. And that was the case for decades, until, theoretically, the 1990s, when freedom of movement was established across the EU and people from the EU were allowed to come here to live and work. But then what happened is they didn't really do that until the 2000s.
Right, so we didn't get large groups, for example, of Spanish people in the way that we were later to do from East European countries.
That's right. So what we did have was skilled workers in sectors such as finance and IT. What we didn't get was lower skilled workers. And the reason for that is throughout the 90s, we had quite high unemployment and the economy was not doing well. And so there was little demand from employers. And I think people often forget this, that labour migration is driven by the economy and by employers' needs.
Right. OK, so 2004, we see the EU expanded to include 10 nations, many from the former Eastern Bloc. What impact did that accession have?
It had a very big impact. And what happened was other EU countries, in particular Germany, decided that they would prevent free movement from those countries. They were allowed to do that for a period. We didn't. So there was a big incentive for people who wanted to exercise their right to free movement to come to the UK.
And was that a significantly higher figure than had been anticipated by policymakers?
It was, because the figures anticipated by policymakers were predicated on the whole of the EU being open to people from those member states. And in fact, it wasn't. But in fact, the takeoff, the increase in migration from those countries happened over time. Really, from 2004, it increased initially up until the recession, 2008-2009. Then it went down. And then we see the real peak in the recovery from recession, when labour demands were particularly high among employers. So it really took off between the period of 2011 and then 2016.
Let's go back a little bit to look at the attitude of the Labour government from 2004, which is the accession time, and 2010 when it goes out of office. How did that government respond to the significant increase in EU inward migration?
So what happened in 2007, Bulgaria and Romania joined the EU. Then the UK put these transitional controls on their entry, not allowing those people to come and live and work in the UK for a further 7 years. And the reason for that was because, on reflection, the government felt that they'd opened the doors to the other countries too early, and they felt that that had impacted particularly on public attitudes to immigration. Then what happened was to introduce a points-based system for migration from outside the EU, which was intended to reduce migration from outside the EU, because there wasn't really much they could do in terms of reducing EU migration. So before 2008, we had a system which included around 80 different visas, incredibly complicated, lots of different ways in which people could come to the UK. And then in 2008, the system was overhauled. So it became a lot more difficult for people from outside the EU to come to the UK.
Right. So essentially, there was an absolutely clear trade-off that they decided to make between EU entrants, which they couldn't stop, and people from outside the EU, which they could.
That's right.
OK. Then in 2010, there was a general election, a change of government. Did the political attitude towards inward migration change?
It did. So David Cameron and Theresa May introduced a target to reduce net migration to tens of thousands, which was never reached.
And at the point when the government was setting this target of tens of thousands, what was the actual number of people who were then coming in?
Over that period, it's probably around 200,000, 300,000, much lower than it is today, but still significantly higher than that target.
Right. Now, moving forward a few years to 2016, we come to the Brexit referendum, of course, and the UK voted to leave the European Union. What happened straight after that?
Well, what happened slightly before that. In the EU, migration peaked in the year to March 2017. So it had already started to fall by the time of the EU referendum. And then it continued falling quite dramatically. Some of that is Brexit related, in that the pound took a tumble, and so people's wages were worth a lot less. And given that a proportion of EU migrants, quite a high proportion, were sending money home, that was an issue for them. Another factor was that the economies in their home countries were improving, and so some decided to go home to take up opportunities there. And I think a third thing that we do need to remember about EU migration is it's not necessary of people coming here permanently to stay. And a proportion of those migrants would have always intended to go back. So in many cases, it was more a question of labour mobility rather than migration.
So are you saying that there's an irony that insofar as immigration was an issue in the referendum, it was actually peaking at the moment of the referendum to then subsequently fall? It would certainly have fallen anyway.
I think it would have fallen anyway. It's probably fallen more than it did. Also bear in mind that people were able to come to the UK under free movement until the beginning of 2021, but they didn't. They've gone elsewhere.
Right, now, from January 2021, as you say, free movement of EU citizens ended. And what have we seen happen since then?
We've seen a continual decrease in people coming from the EU. They're about 5% of migration for work, which is pretty low. And we've seen a big increase in migration from outside the EU, both for work and for study.
Why did that happen?
It happened because we introduced a new points-based system, and that started in 2021, and that made it easier for employers to recruit from outside the EU, well, from anywhere. The new system doesn't include a cap on numbers, and it has a lower skills threshold than the previous system that allowed employers to recruit from outside the EU. Also reduced the salary requirements. In particular, the health and social care sector is using it.
Heather Rolfe. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes, in the week that COP28 in Dubai starts, the one on Can We Meet the Net Zero Challenge, the one on Fighting Drought, and the one on Adapting to a Hotter Britain. Now, back to immigration. Finally, I want to understand the effect that government policy has had on the immigration figures and to evaluate some of the options open to it. Madeline Sumption is Director of the Migration Observatory at the University of Oxford. Madeline Sumption, if current immigration policy stays broadly the same, what could we project numbers to do in the years ahead?
I think it's reasonable to assume that net migration to the UK, that's the figure that's been really high recently at 670,000, that figure will start to come down even if policy remains the same, partly because when immigration goes up, typically you see a couple of years later that emigration goes up too, and that brings down the net figures. But there
Sorry, is that because quite a lot of those people who are coming in actually then also go out again?
That's right. So particularly international students in the past, the large majority of them have left within a few years. And so when you have more international students coming in, we expect to see an increase in emigration of international students. However, there are some big uncertainties. And the two biggest ones, in my view, are what happens to work visas, because there's been a really sharp increase in the number of people getting work visas. And if that continues to go up, then we might not see big declines in net migration. The other uncertainty is international students. It's possible that a much larger share of international students coming in will stay than they did in the past, and that would also affect the net migration figures in the coming years.
I don't suppose you'd care to give us a guess as to what will actually happen in figure terms.
Well, the most recent net migration figures that we had were around 670,000. I think that if you assume immigration stays roughly the same, but perhaps there are reductions in a couple of categories, then it's reasonable to assume that net migration may fall to somewhere in the 300,000 range. But it's extremely uncertain, and there are plausible scenarios where it remains much higher, perhaps as high as 400,000 in the long run, depending on what happens to immigration.
But that all still feels quite a lot less than the 600,000 figure, but quite a lot higher than the figure before the pandemic.
Yes, exactly. So before the pandemic, the expectation was very much that as a result of Brexit, net migration to the UK would go down from the levels it had been at the time, which was in the range of 200,000 to 300,000. I think it no longer looks likely that we'll see much lower levels of migration than pre-Brexit, largely because of the increase in work visas, although obviously that's sensitive to policy and we'll see what happens on the policy front.
Let's get into exactly what you're saying, which is the policy front. Because this week there was a story that the former Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, had struck a deal with Prime Minister Rishi Sunak over a four-point migration plan. It was kind of spelled out, really. So let's look through those particular points and use them as a kind of exemplar of policy. First of all, there was a pledge to increase the minimum salary for a skilled worker arriving in the UK from 26,000 to 40,000. What difference would it make if that policy were implemented?
The impacts of raising salary thresholds depend a lot on who it applies to. And in particular, the biggest question is, do you exempt the care sector or not? And the reason that's such a big deal is that around half of skilled work visas in the most recent period that we have data for went to care workers.
Half?
Half. This is a dramatic change from in the past. So we've got half going to care workers. We then have another 20% or so that are going to other jobs like NHS workers who are actually not affected by the salary thresholds at all because they have their own system for setting pay under the NHS system. So if you exempt care from the salary thresholds, you're actually looking at quite a small share of people getting work visas who would actually be subject to the thresholds at all. And many of them are already earning 30, 40, 50,000 and so wouldn't be dramatically affected. If you don't exempt care from an increase in the salary threshold, then potentially the impact on the numbers is much greater. You're effectively looking at closing down the care route because it's very unlikely that employers would be able to bring care workers in at even 30,000, certainly not 40,000. And the impacts of that would be quite significant for the care sector, although it depends what else you do. So it could be that you could close down the care route and spend a lot more money on paying UK care workers to attract them into those jobs. That's something that politicians have not managed to do in the last several years because it's an expensive proposition.
Could you just explain exactly how this salary threshold works?
There are different salary thresholds. So an employer bringing someone into a particular job would usually have to pay what's known as the going rate for that job. And that depends on the occupation. So it's going to be much higher for pilots than it is for care workers, for example. There's then also a salary threshold, which is currently roughly 26,000, below which employers are not able to bring in workers unless they're in the shortage occupation list. And care workers are the main group of people who are paid less than 26,000. They can come in on around 21,000 because they're deemed to be in shortage.
The shortage occupation list.
This is a list of occupations in which employers are allowed to bring people in on lower wages. It's the main mechanism through which care workers have been able to come to the UK on what actually are pretty low wages of around £21,000. If you scrap the shortage occupation list but exempt care, under the current system with a salary threshold of around 26,000, I don't think it would make much difference at all because the vast majority of people coming in on salaries less than that are care workers. However, if you had a much higher salary threshold, let's say you were talking about 40 or 45,000, then the impact of a shortage occupation list that might let certain people coming in at, say, 30,000 might be bigger.
Now, presumably that has other effects as well in the other occupations that you're now increasing the salary level for.
If you increase the salary threshold, then depending on exactly where you increase it to, different occupations are going to fall into the net. So, for example, butchers and chefs are among the largest occupations where you have workers coming in at around 26,000. So employers are effectively paying basically the minimum that they're allowed to under the immigration system. Now, if you had a significantly higher salary threshold for everyone, then a lot of those people wouldn't be able to come in anymore unless they were on a shortage occupation list. So it's when you have a higher salary threshold that potentially a shortage occupation list makes a big difference.
Okay, right. And who's recommending this?
The scrapping the shortage occupation list. This is the Migration Advisory Committee. And in the interest of disclosure, I'm on that committee, although I'm not talking in that capacity today.
Also in the deal, there was a plan to, it's a quote, close down the graduate visa route. What do you understand that to mean and what impact would that have?
The graduate visa allows people who have been international students in the UK to work for a couple of years after they have finished their courses. And it is one of the factors, probably quite a significant factor, that has driven the substantial increase that we've seen in the number of international students coming to the UK. So if you were to close it down, it's hard to project exactly what the impacts would be, but it's likely that there would be at least some decrease in the number of international students if the UK became a little bit less attractive to them. In terms of the impacts of that, for the overall economy, probably the impacts would not be very big. Where you would see an impact would be in the higher education sector, and particularly certain institutions. So if you think that some of the most selective institutions that reject a lot of well-qualified candidates might simply just go lower down their lists, and so they would still be able to accept the same number of people. However, if you're looking at less selective institutions that aren't turning away a lot of qualified candidates, then there you may see a reduction in the numbers. International students play quite an important role in the funding of higher education because they pay fees that then subsidise the education of domestic students. Universities actually make a loss educating domestic students and they make that up with international students. And over the last 20 years, the higher education sector has become a lot more dependent on international student fee revenue.
Another aspect of the Braverman-Sunak compact or non-compact was restricting the numbers of dependents. As you understood that, was that targeted at a particular sector?
Well, the government has already announced that they will introduce a restriction on the family members of international students starting next year. The other area where we have seen rising numbers of dependents coming in through the immigration system is in work visas, and particularly the health and care visa, although nothing formally has been announced on that stage, and so it's not clear at this point if a restriction were to be introduced, whether it would apply to everyone on health and care or other skilled work visas, or whether it would just be to specific workers.
Since the publication of the revised net migration figures last week, the Immigration Minister, Robert Jenrick, in the House of Commons, signalled he wanted a hard cap on immigration numbers. Let's imagine he could have it. What impact might that have?
We need to distinguish between a political target and a hard cap. So a political target, which we've had in the past, is when politicians simply say, we would like, say, net migration or immigration, whatever it is, to be at roughly this level. And then maybe they achieve that, maybe they don't. In the past, the answer was that they don't, but we'll see. Now, that's very different from a hard cap, where you actually just stop issuing visas once you get to a certain number. What happens then when you reach the cap? What happens if you're oversubscribed? You then have to decide who gets visas and who doesn't. Do you have random selection through a lottery? Do you allow a backlog to build up with long delays? What we saw in the UK case when there was a cap on skilled work visas in the 2010s was that it can introduce a little bit of randomness and unpredictability. Economists really struggle to defend this policy because it's difficult to implement and it creates the risk of arbitrary, unpredictable outcomes. Effectively, whether this person qualifies for a visa in this month depends not on their qualifications, but on who else happened to apply in the same month. So I think it is really difficult to implement hard caps in a rational way.
All of these policies have trade-offs. Is there an inbuilt conflict, I'm beginning to wonder, between the Home Office tasked with reducing migration and pretty much everybody else tasked with running an economy, running universities, running a health service?
I think there is a real challenge here, and we see it not just among politicians, but in public as well. So if you ask in public opinion surveys, do people want to reduce migration, then many of them will say yes, there is quite a lot of support for reducing migration. However, if you ask about specific routes, would you like Ukrainians to come here, do you want skilled workers, then people tend to be much more favourable. And I think the challenge is that there is just a natural conflict between these two things, and we see it among the public, we also see it among politicians.
Do you think we're sufficiently honest in this country about this issue?
I think what is not very helpful is to talk about absolute numbers, so we will reduce migration from X to Y, without any discussion about how to actually do that. Because it's very easy to say that migration will come down, but if you're not actually going to implement that in specific policies that will reduce particular categories of migration, and particularly the large ones where the numbers actually are, so for example, care workers or international students, then you end up in a situation where promises are made that then can't be kept.
Madeline Sumption, my conclusion? Looks like we could bring down migration figures if we wanted, but if we do, we'll have to do things like increase wages in areas like social care, increase the attractiveness of jobs to people abroad who've got no families, and fund universities in the UK on a different basis to the current one. So, no easy solutions. My thanks to Jay Lindop, Heather Rolfe and Madeline Sumption. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Sally Abrahams, Kirsty Knight and Alex Lewis. The sound engineer was Neil Churchill and the editor is Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
I love you.
Hello there.
Carolyn is 80, a wealthy widow. Dave is in his 50s, homeless, a former drug addict with a long criminal record. Their love affair causes a huge rift in Carolyn's family.
That's our mom. We're not going to let you just do that.
I'm Sue Mitchell, and this story unfolded in California on the street where I live.
Look at you brought into your house.
He's a con artist, mother.
Is Dave a dangerous interloper or the tender carer he claims to be?
That's why I'm here.
Thank the Lord.
Find out in Intrigue, Million Dollar Lover from BBC Radio 4. Listen on BBC Sounds.
If anything happens to you, I will just die.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello, Greg Jenner here, host of You're Dead to Me. In my new family-friendly podcast series, Dead Funny History, historical figures come back to life for just about long enough to argue with me, tell us their life stories, and sometimes get on my nerves. There's 15 lovely episodes to unwrap, including the life of Ramses the Great, Josephine Baker, and the history of football, plus much, much more. So this Christmas, give your ears a treat with Dead Funny History. You can find it in the You're Dead to Me feed on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.